Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. We'll be talking to two folks on Change Surfer Radio today. First, I'll be speaking with Alex Alanis. He's the author of Beyond Future Shock and an essay called Transhuman Conflict and Conflict Resolution Research. Then I'll be speaking with Lucas Shapiro, who's the national organizer for the Young Democratic Socialists Organization. We'll be talking about the state of the student left and its priorities. So stay tuned first for our interview with Alex Alanis. Alex is a particle physicist working at Los Alamos National Labs. He's a former protein folding physicist and econometrician. And he's the author of a new novel called Beyond Future Shock, which explores a number of transhumanist themes, and an essay, accompanying essay that kind of works out some of the nonfiction issues called Transhuman Conflict and Conflict Resolution Research. Your novel is very interesting. It starts in the midst of German conflict. Does it start with World War One?
Yeah, it starts at the last day of World War One.
Last day of World War One, and then it goes up through the rise of fascism and the protagonists live under then.
They're upper crust Germans and, connected with Hitler and the Hitler Youth Movement. And they're kids, though.
Right.
And they grow up through the Cold War and get separated and all the way up to modern times.
Right. So the inadvertent Hitlerjugend like Pope Benedict.
You know. Exactly. Exactly.
and then it comes right up to the 21st century, and you have this very transhumanist scenario of people uploading into their consciousnesses into mind space servers, as you call them, and achieving this post-corporeal existence. So that's one of the things that we want to address here, which is that you see this as a scenario that's coming down the pike. You agree that there's going to be some kind of post-corporeal existence possible.
I have no doubt about it. The first time I mean, I've been hoping for these kinds of things as a kid, and in the first book that ever organized it, my ideas was Ray Kurzweil's Age of Spiritual Machines book a few years back, and it was shocking to me. I always thought it was going to happen, but I didn't realize it was as close as it seems to be.
In your Transhuman Conflict essay, you mentioned the cyberkinetics chip, which is now being implanted in people with severe paralysis as one of the harbingers of this, and I've been mentioning that to people as well, and very few people seem aware of that.
Even at Los Alamos, full of, the world's smartest people, according to our business card.
Yeah. And so when you talk to folks in the military culture about some of these scenarios, is that how you got interested in, how the conflict scenarios might evolve? Because it seemed to be a natural topic that would come up, is how's this going to affect our preparedness, our national defense, and things like that?
Well, I read a lot of history, and it seems like the central theme of history is war. And in the military, one of my jobs is to be an analyst looking for worst-case scenarios and applications of new weapons and how effective they are. So what I see, actually, is beyond my military background, is an innate tendency of humans to be actively competitive. I mean, Darwinian evolution is about accidental advantages, or not. Something fails because it was a lousy mutation or confers superiority and so on. But with humans, I see it as intelligence is an active extension of Darwinian evolution. And I began to think, in your book, for instance, you talk about a negative feedback. If you're poor, your nutrition isn't as good. Your job, kills your mind. And if you're richer, you live longer, you eat better, you have a stimulating environment. And you have these gradients that set up. And I, looking at the worst case, I thought, well, maybe one day Bill Gates will eat us. And what I mean by that is, and I really am convinced that not too long from now, we're going to say, for first of all, for purposes of curing Alzheimer's, start putting chips in our heads. And eventually, where the chip ends, where the brain ends, who knows? And we may begin to occupy, these borderless mind space servers. And what's going to stop human competition? What's going to stop, our aggressiveness? There's nothing innate in the universe that would. And I think, if you're a billionaire, you might suddenly become, this incredible super being. And if you're a poor African, you stay human. And what's going to stop competition once this happens? And what kind of laws, or how do we control this kind of conflict?
Well, your essays raise these questions, but don't come to very many answers yet. Have you begun to think about what kinds of answers there might be? I mean, this is the stuff of public policy. How do we resolve conflicts? What kinds of state structures or non-state structures are possible to resolve these kinds of conflicts?
Well, there's various ideas I explore in the science fiction book, and I wouldn't say any of them are any more than preliminary ideas. I mean, we need to begin to think about these things now, and I think a great idea would be to take something like SimCity, except in a world where people can upload their brains and let the world play this. You know, we can simulate the future and see what happens and see where the real problems begin. You know, will stockbrokers start cracking into their neighbor's stockbroker brains, or you know, what's going to happen? How are people going to try to cheat? What's on the small scale and the big scale? So I think we need to explore this. I don't think there are any solutions yet until we actually begin to characterize the problems.
I don't know if you saw the news recently. There was a Chinese man who was arrested because he had written a program that entered one of these massive multi role playing games that, you know, 500,000 people participate in. Vision Quest, or these different role-playing games like Sims Online.
Okay.
And he had written a program that went around and mugged people and actually stole electronically in the game, stole their stuff. And then he aggregated their stuff electronically and then sold it in the real world, for real money to other people who are playing this game who wanted that sword or that rock or that house or whatever inside the virtual reality. So, you know, and now they've had problems with prostitution. There are people who are hiring detectives to track down their spouse's electronic liaisons within
right.
these virtual worlds. So all of the problems, you know, as you're pointing to here, all the problems that we see in the real world, the physical world, will be emulated in these virtual existences as they become more and more real.
That's one of the things I try to make people imagine. And once the three quarters of the book is historical fiction, the last quarter is the future. And in that, I things begin to go bad for the planet. People think that they've cheated death. They're uploaded. They're, you know, as long as a meteor doesn't hit the Earth, they're fine. But I have a financial analyst who usurps his company's massive computers, starts cracking into the minds of his junior financial analysts, and takes over them and speculates on the market and gets away with it until there's a power surge, and suddenly these former zombies go to the virtual police, and it becomes a mess at first legally. You know, people, it becomes a soap opera thing. You know, wives of this analyst are claiming rape of the people who are cheated out of the financial assets, are claiming, you know, fraud. And then people begin to realize, oh no, I mean, who's real, who's not real, and who's making these chips? And it becomes a real mess after that, and when a war breaks out basically on all scales, from small people, I think of it like a Jurassic Park war, except at the speed of light, billionaires to ordinary people, you know, this incredibly advanced pace evolutionary war going on about 30, 40 years from now.
This is the book that you're talking about is your novel Beyond
right.
Future Shock, which is available from Amazon and other sources. One of the first essays that I know of that explores some of the things that you're concerned about here is an old essay by an economist named Robin Hanson.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, when the crack of a future dawn or something like that. But at any rate, he says, what would the economic consequences be of people uploading into computers? And
right.
projects things like...
I just became familiar with this work very recently.
Yeah. Well, he says everyone will start doing their work in these virtual spaces at much faster rates, and so the humans who are trying to compete against them won't be able to compete economically, and eventually they'll all die off, and then there'll be all this aggregation of wealth within the matrix space. And eventually we all will be working for or eaten by Bill Gates, as you said,
yeah.
the virtual Bill Gates. And so he has this very dystopian scenario. But, you know, I mention it in my book also, and I say, you know, one of the things that he discounts is the notion that anyone would organize to make sure that that scenario didn't come about. I mean, I think, you know, when we think about these future scenarios, we have to include human agency, as you're
right.
doing here. You're
right.
saying, you know, how people will... see this coming down the pike, hopefully, and try
right.
to organize some solution to it.
I imagine in my worst-case scenario, an average person, an average American uploading their brain, say, into a smallish mind space capability machine, and someone like a billionaire uploading their minds into a massive thing that requires, you know, nuclear reactors to power. I mean, right now, Bill Gates can't eat more calories per day than the poorest person. You know, maybe 1,000 for the poorest person, maybe 5,000 for Bill Gates on a given day. But once Bill Gates can transcend, say, or a billionaire can transcend and become this massive being, then think of the things this being might be able to do. And with, you know, running all sorts of parallel processes, might be able to continue advancing chips and controlled by nanobots or robots of various sizes, augmenting himself or itself, while we have much more limited capabilities. We can't take, you know, that being won't necessarily have to share its advances with us. And so it pulls ahead of us technologically, and at such a rate that, you know, we're starved out. You know, it's the same way we're starving out so many species. And so, I mean, that's the worst case scenario I see, and I think we need to address that before that's allowed to happen.
So you have a very dystopian take on the notion of the singularity, that once all this super intelligence begins to take off, that it will lead immediately to this apocalyptic conflict. I think, you know, what a lot of people have non-dystopian or utopian views of how that might occur, because they imagine, for instance, that once we're all inside these electronic spaces and have our consciousness fully malleable, why would we want to maintain our Darwinian competitive instincts? Or why would we compete over physical resources in meat space when we have everything that we could possibly want,
right?
That we could manifest electronically? You could have every experience that you could possibly imagine with just a minimum of electrical current, you know?
I hope that's true.
You think, yeah, you know, but you don't think it's going to be true.
No, I do think I'm basically looking at the worst case. I am not a bioludite. Absolutely hope for, you know, as you call for, a super democracy with liberated beings able to explore, you know, the universe indefinitely, however long the universe permits us to exist. I definitely hope for all these kinds of things. But I definitely see, even amongst the scientists at Los Alamos, this ignorance of what I see is coming. You know, what lots of people are beginning to see is not too far away, and I think a great way to popularize this is to look at the worst cases, and kind of like Carl Sagan's Nuclear Winter made people stop and think.
One of the issues that you raise in your essay, Transhuman Conflict and Conflict Resolution Research, is that personality becomes back upable, mm-hmm. It will problematize the notion of murder and various kinds of assaults. There's in Charlie Strauss's Accelerando novel, which is one of the big singularity books that are out this year, a science fiction novel. He has a kind of quasi dystopian view of what a post singularity childhood might be like, that instead of playing violent games online and shooting, you have first person shooters, the kids would actually kill each other, mm-hmm. as a part of, you know, just to feel the experience, because then they would be able to immediately reinstantiate themselves in some other way, you know, biologically or in nanotechnology or something like that. And similarly, an electronic experience, you could imagine that the tastes of for people for extreme experiences, you know, torture, mutilation, things like that, might get quite out of control. Those are some of the more, again, more dystopian scenarios of what might happen.
And I think it's something we have to think about. And I do email with Charlie every once in a while. It's something we have to think about, because there is, if you look at history, there's something innate in us. We like to self-organize. We've obviously built a civilization over thousands of years. But there's something innate in us that it leads us to war all the time. And it seems to me to be just an extension, an intelligent, active extension of Darwinian evolution. You know, looking for niches, looking for things to exploit. And we need to figure out ways to control this. And I believe in a democratic process. But even today's democracy, which is not perfect in the modern world, has allowed these incredible wealth gradients to come to existence. I mean, I don't know if it takes 1 billion of the poorest people or 2 billion of the poorest people to equal one of our billionaires today. I mean, these are incredible wealth gradients.
That's one of the things that, as you know, I'm wrote this book about democratic transhumanism and the need for there to be a feedback between democratization of technology and the technology. So, is that something that you're looking at, the need for a political movement?
I totally agree with that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think your book is the nonfiction version of my book.
I've been speaking with Alex Alanis. He is a particle physicist at the Los Alamos National Lab and a former officer in the Air Force, a private pilot, a former protein folding physicist, and author of Beyond Future Shock, which is a science fiction novel that explores from the close of World War I through a post-human future, the various permutations of love and conflict, and also the author of the essay, Transhuman Conflict and Conflict Resolution Research, which can be found at transhumanism.org. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.
Stay tuned for a chat with Lucas Shapiro, the national organizer for the Young Democratic Socialists. Welcome, Lucas. You just completed your national annual conference of the YDS there in New York City. And the YDS is the youth wing of the Democratic Socialists of America, the largest democratic socialist organization in the United States. And you had, I understand, about 50 activists there in New York?
Yeah, it was actually at a small castle about 45 minutes north of New York City, kind of retreat style. And we had a bunch of great speakers, some workshops, and skill trainings, and just some time for people to hang out and kind of strategize at the same time.
So what's the current state of the student left? Are things on the upswing, or has the opposition to the Iraq war galvanized some interest in the student movement?
I think it's a mixed bag. Certainly there were a lot of people that were politicized in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq, and then also pretty substantial layers of people were involved in the efforts to remove Bush from office in the 2004 elections. I think a lot of that is still kind of a bit disoriented now. There's still, this is probably a trait that's been going on for generations, but there's still quite a bit of cynicism and apathy among the student population. But there are some signs of hope, and there's some new kind of activist campaigns and organizations that are out there that are doing some really good, effective work that, I think is worth building off of their momentum.
I see that the YDS has joined the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition. Is that principally an Iraq war-focused coalition?
We actually formed shortly after September 11th and did some work in opposition to aspects of the Bush policy in Afghanistan. And that's when we came together. It's a coalition of national student and youth organizations, both progressive and radical groups, and it represents a pretty large swath of the organized student left in this country. And we've continued to do work on, opposing the war in Iraq and the occupation and kind of highlighting how these, the war at home affects young people here in this country in terms of cutbacks to education spending or, the attacks on civil liberties, how certain targeted populations are impacted, and then also just the need to challenge this kind of militaristic U.S. foreign policy that, is really right now the kind of focal point for a lot of activism.
One of the priorities for the student movement in recent years has been the anti-globalization movement and various efforts to educate people about the consequences of unfair trade and the need for fair trade. The YDS is a member of the International Union of Socialist Youth, so it's affiliated with young socialists all around the world. And I was just wondering if the globalization movement and the connection with YUSI has been a focus for YDS in recent years, as not only this foreign policy focus in terms of the war, but also fair trade.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually one of the issues, too, that did galvanize a lot of student activists, especially before September 11th, after the protests in Seattle against the World Trade Organization. There was, kind of a burgeoning student anti-sweatshop movement on campus that's still, going strong today with organizations like United Students Against Sweatshops, the Student Labor Action Project, and others that are doing some really fantastic work, both kind of international solidarity campaign with workers in developing countries, but then also an increasing focus on, campus living wage campaigns, doing community work within, the areas where schools are based to fight for workers' rights. And certainly our connection with UCI, the International Union of Socialist Youth, which no one's heard of in this country, but it's actually the world's largest political coalition of young people. They've also, you know, put a lot of emphasis on, you know, fighting what is essentially a system of global economic apartheid, where, you know, the gap between the haves and have-nots is continues to be, you know, absolutely unacceptable, and it's one of the most extreme manifestations people have been protesting against. And UCI has done some campaigning around the third world debt and other policies, you know, through some of the multilateral institutions like the UN and other financial agreements to push for clauses that protect the rights of workers and the environment.
I'm speaking with Lucas Shapiro. He's the national organizer for the Young Democratic Socialists, which can be found at ydsusa.org. Another perennial issue within democratic socialist organizations in the U.S., at any rate, is the relationship to the Democratic Party, and the relationship has had its ups and downs. I was wondering, since the Bush ascension, I assume that the attitude towards electoral work within the Dems is more favorable among young democratic socialists?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think there's always been a very strong current of our folks that viewed building the kind of progressive wing of the Democratic Party as a pretty central task. You know, some people are more cynical or jaundiced to the prospects of what you can actually accomplish within the Democratic Party, especially in the context where, you know, the more kind of pro-corporate right-wing elements under the Democratic Leadership Council were really in the ascendancy. But I think there was, you know, a pretty substantial grassroots mobilization to defeat Bush this time around. That included people that are much more open to, you know, like a, you know, progressive economic and social agenda. And I think a lot of those people recognize that building a progressive, you know, governing majority is predominantly going to be done through the Democratic Party, you know, whether we like it or not. That the U.S. is a very peculiar electoral system that imposes certain limitations on us, since we don't have, you know, proportional representation. There's not really coalition governments. And the state and not the parties themselves control who can run on their ballots. There's really not too much party discipline. So that's one of the things that I try and do is, you know, people that are on the left that sometimes are pretty cynical and dismissive of doing electoral politics is explaining why we have this kind of unique system in this country and what that means in terms of working with folks in the Democratic Party. But then also there's a lot of work that can be done outside of the Democratic Party, you know, in the labor movement, feminist groups, environmental groups, which tend to have a relationship with the Democratic Party, either in direct support or, you know, as a lobbying effort. But I think anyone that's completely dismissive of or doesn't see building a progressive wing of the Democratic Party as a good thing, you know, maybe is not too grounded in the reality of the American political landscape.
Since the ascension of Howard Dean as a figure within the Democratic Party, now the party chairman, and also the founding of an organization, the Progressive Democrats of America, do you see greater interest or opportunities, openings for DSA-YDS collaboration with Progressive Democrats? Are Progressive Democrats on the ascendancy within the party?
Certainly would like to. I mean, again, you know, being that the U.S. is the most anti-socialist country in the democratic world, you know, our possibilities in terms of organizing are always going to be hampered because of the kind of narrow political spectrum here. But yeah, and actually, that's one of the things that came out of our retreat was where we have this new electoral committee to kind of explore some of those possibilities, looking at, you know, different organizations, including folks like the Progressive Democrats of America, which haven't really developed much of a campus or student effort to this point. You know, but there's a lot of other groups too that are doing some good work, and we'd like to develop some outreach materials and some talking points for folks that are doing both kind of movement building and electoral politics at the same time.
So give me the short list. What's the short list of campaigns and issues that you're going to be pressing this fall?
Well, I mean, one thing that I think is kind of nice about, you know, being a socialist is that really any issue is your issue. and that we give our chapters and members quite a bit of autonomy in terms of developing their own political priorities. But, you know, we're trying, part of our mission is to help connect the dots, to get people to be effective multi-issue organizers that show that there's that kind of overlapping systems of oppression and exploitation. So if it's doing, you know, some economic justice work, fighting against the low-wage economy, how that impacts on young people in terms of the, you know, skyrocketing tuition costs, and students are graduating increasingly with a tremendous debt burden, and, you know, there's not so many living wage jobs out there for folks, you know, or if it's, you know, doing anti-racist work and community organizing, some feminist stuff, reproductive rights, gay rights, you know, again, challenging U.S. foreign policy, a whole range of things that I think, you know, part of our mission is to get people to kind of develop a coherent analysis and kind of seeing that single issue activism alone isn't going to get us very far, that we really need to be fighting for kind of a broader, you know, left plank, and be there for each other's struggles too, so that we're not organizing in isolation from each other.
That's been one of the real challenges for a multi-tenancy, multi-issue organization like YDS, as opposed to these single-issue groups. And that always was an attraction for me to the notion that you would have a comprehensive ideology that would fit it all together. But it seems like there's a declining demand for those kind of comprehensive ideological approaches and an increasing attraction for these single-issue type coalitions.
I think some of that's true. I mean, I do think that there are more people now than perhaps, you know, past 10 years or so that are thinking in more systemic terms, that are open, you know, to some of challenging the, you know, what people call neoliberal globalization. But how that's expressed in terms of their political commitments, you know, I think there is kind of a skepticism for groups that pretend to have all the answers and tie it all together. That's actually one of the things that we try and do is be very kind of, you know, upfront and modest about what we're trying to do. I mean, we're trying to promote people that take, you know, politics seriously, but again, not pretending to know the answer to everything or to have some kind of quick fix solution for things. It's, you know, the world's a complicated place. But yeah, no, that there needs to be more cooperation on the left, and that there needs to be more folks that are connecting the dots, that are doing coalition building. So, you know, I think kind of some of it is you lead through example. If you're an organization that is seen as working in principled coalition with other groups and that you're doing some good work to raise a whole set of issues that are kind of often neglected from mainstream political debate, that, you know, folks will take a liking to you and perhaps even, you know, make a commitment to the organization themselves.
I've been speaking with Lucas Shapiro. He's the national organizer for the Young Democratic Socialists of America, and I found him on the streets of New York City. So that's, the audio quality is partly explained by the fact that he is in situ organizing there in New York City, or at least having a good time. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us, Lucas.
Thank you very much.
And good luck with your organizing this fall.
All right. Take care.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.